In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, November 24th, 2014. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program Gary Chartier. We've had Gary on in the past to talk about several topics, including two of his books. We've talked about radicalizing Rawls and his book, The Conscience of an Anarchist. Well, today he's going to talk to us about themes in his very important work, Anarchy and Legal Order, Law and Politics for a Stateless Society. Gary Chartier is a professor of law and business ethics and associate dean at the business school at La Sierra University in Riverside, California. He holds a JD from UCLA and his PhD from Cambridge University. Gary, welcome back to the show.
It's awesome to be with you, Tom.
Gary, I haven't had you on in a long time, and the main reason is this book I want to talk to you about is a bear, not in the sense that it's hard to read or it's complicated. It's long, and it's long in the sense that it's packed with information. It's not one of these breezy books that you can skip 30 pages and feel like you didn't lose anything. This is an extremely systematic presentation of a difficult argument to make, frankly. And I want to do this thing justice, and we may not be able to do it justice in just one episode. I want to start off by asking you, this topic of anarchy and the law, which is the title of your book, has been covered by a number of people. Now, certainly, there is a vast amount of work to be done in this area. It's still very much virgin territory. But I do want to know, in your estimation, where do you think your contributions are? You don't have to give us the specifics, but in what areas of this question do you think you're bringing something new to the table?
Well, so a lot of modern kind of market anarchist, market libertarian theory in the last 50 to 100 years has been rooted broadly in natural law thinking. But there are different strands of natural law thinking, and what I've tried to do in this book is to ask whether one particularly, I think, interesting and sophisticated version of contemporary natural law theory, a version that is often associated in the minds of its proponents and readers as well, with a pretty conventionally statist approach, could be recast to provide a grounding for a full-blown libertarian anarchist position. What would it take to do that? So this book attempts to build on one particular strand then of natural law thinking, one that runs from Aristotle to Aquinas through to contemporary figures like Germain Grisé and John Finnis, and ask what a version of that theory that provided a solid grounding for a free society might actually look like. That's probably the most significant contribution the book makes, though I hope it does some other things as well.
Well, in, I guess, chapter 3, you make a case that, of course, we need some of the goods, anyway, that the state provides. We don't deny that we need them. We do need law, and we do need security. But in chapter 3, you give reasons that we should rule out the state as the institution providing these services. Now, this is easy for a libertarian to understand, but all the same, what's the general gist of your argument? And incidentally, I should point out to people, this book is published by, is it Cambridge University Press?
Cambridge, yeah.
So it's not our usual audience necessarily. So you do have to review arguments that might be familiar to listeners of this program when you're dealing with an audience, an academic audience at that level.
Yeah, so the argument in Chapter 3 is the crucial argument for anarchy. So in the previous chapter, Chapter 2, I have used the resources of the natural law approach I'm exploring and defending to ground a robust account of property rights. The natural law approach tends to be favorable to property rights, but its proponents often have seen those rights as a lot more malleable and a lot more subject to interference than I think that we ought to see them as being. So I try to show how within the terms of that theory, one can adduce reasons for robust property rights. Once I've done that, I can then go on to the next chapter, to chapter three, building on an understanding of property rights as grounded in natural law theory. Then we can see how states interfere with those property rights, and that's certainly one reason why we ought to be suspicious of states, their systematic interference with property rights. But also, I suggest a whole range of other reasons that have to do with the way in which states are predictably and persistently rapacious and exploitative. I look at the history of state power, not in a detailed way, certainly not in a way that would do justice to what you as a historian would want, but I at least try to survey some issues there. And I talk about the reasons that we might draw from resources like game theory and economics and social psychology for expecting that people could, in fact, maintain social order on their own without the aid of Leviathan, without the aid of some top-down controller. So Chapter 3 is packed then with a lot of stuff. We begin with a presumption against interference with the property rights said in the previous chapter, show that states do this, and show that states aren't needed to do the things that their proponents think they're needed to do, and therefore that interference isn't justified. So that's, I guess, a short version of what is, as you point out, a fairly long chapter.
Gary, just to whet the appetites of the listeners, I actually want to read the subheadings of this chapter because they are so provocative that you want to drop everything and go read it. Going from numbers 1 through 7, the state is inimical to peaceful voluntary cooperation. And then Gary elaborates on that. Peaceful voluntary cooperation is an aspect of and a crucial precondition for a flourishing life. Then, state actors' refusal to cooperate with others on a peaceful, voluntary basis is highly problematic. Then, the state is not needed to ensure peaceful, voluntary cooperation. Then, the state is not needed to ensure peaceful, voluntary cooperation in the production of crucial public goods. Then, the state is dangerous. And then, embracing peaceful, voluntary cooperation means rejecting the state. And then followed by an appendix. You have a section in Chapter 4. Legal codes in a stateless society would have varied sources and contents, but might exhibit common features. I want to talk about this because it's hard for people to imagine law without the state. And at least one of the reasons is that it seems that different peoples would give rise to different codes of law that might be incompatible with one another. Now, part of the answer to that would be you already live in a system like that. People live in different jurisdictions and they're subject to different kinds of law, but what we would be proposing here would be not geographically based, but it would be based, it would still be a system, though, that in which people might live under different sorts of legal arrangements. The question I have for you is one that's always bugged me about this, which is people sure. have completely different first principles. A lot of times you'll have people, well, people like us, for example, we believe in private property rights, but there could be other people in some aspects of the socialist tradition who would reject all property. Like, imagine the most radical anti-property people. How could peoples living under those two completely different approaches to understanding life and property live together in peace side by side? It seems to be taken for granted in libertarian and anarcho-capitalist, or I'm sorry, I know you don't like that term, but in anarchist analyses of this, yeah, that's I'll have to have you on for another show for that, but it's sure. like they take for granted that, well, somehow it'll all work out that it's libertarian. But these people are not going to abide by that. How could I have a legal case against somebody who doesn't think he's trespassing on my property because he doesn't accept the same first principles I do? You see what I'm driving at?
Absolutely, Tom. And I do think that that's one of the it's one of the biggest challenges that any anarchist model faces, whether it's a Marxian anarchist model that takes property rights seriously or any number of other anarchist models. Anarchists of all sorts recognize the variety, the diversity of people's commitments and preferences, and the question then becomes how those might be coordinated. And it's tempting to be snarky here, right, to think of that infamous cartoon that shows the enormous equation drawn out on a blackboard by the scientist, and then at one point you see, and then a miracle occurs.
Right.
And I do find sometimes that libertarians talking about this will say, in effect, well, the foundation of the society will be everybody gets together and agrees on a basic set of rules. And one wants to say, well, that would be wonderful, but it hardly seems likely. So what that means, I think, is that unavoidably a free society is a work in progress. You'd like to think that good rules, rules that commend themselves to reason, rules that can, in fact, help to maintain social order across diverse groups, you know, will tend to commend themselves to people's reflection. But we obviously recognize that it's not always that simple. The model that I want to defend here is not one that assumes that everyone in the society will embrace all of my arguments for robust property rights and protections against torture and violence and so forth, the underlying commitment to non-aggression that I seek to elaborate and defend in the book. I hope people will, and I'd like to think that sensible legal codes will embody those rules. I recognize that's not always going to be the case. So what I think instead we have to assume is that even when people don't share underlying commitments, one thing that they are likely to share is a desire, if possible, to cooperate and avoid violence. Now, we can't guarantee that that will be true for everyone, but it seems likely that we can count on a modicum of agreement between the different organizations and associations and so forth that promote dispute resolution, even if their members don't, in fact, always embrace the same ideological commitment, because those associations themselves will want to avoid violence. Violence is costly on multiple levels, and they'll want to craft agreements with each other that will enable them to protect their members at minimal cost. And cost here need not, using the language of cost, need not imply that all of these are commercial. As you point out, there might well be groups that really would be anti-commercial. Nonetheless, those groups still aren't going to want violence, still aren't going to want to be involved in violent conflict over various issues. And so I think we can't expect perfect solutions. We can't expect complete agreement, but we can hope for two things: that different, we can broadly say, protective associations will tend to want to craft agreements with each other relating to conflicts between their members that will minimize violence, and that for reasons of efficiency, there will be a measure of convergence on similar rules. It's not perfect, but I think it is an approach that will tend to reduce costs and minimize conflict to a significant extent, and then leave room for peaceful advocacy, we hope, to lead people to increasingly commit to what I would regard as sensible rules. Can't guarantee that at all, but I think we can expect conflict-reducing and violence-reducing to back to action.
All right, let's go to an even more fundamental question. Where is law coming from in the absence of the state?
Well, so it's a good question, Tom. And when people ask the question that way, they often seem to be presupposing a kind of positivist view. They assume that law, normative law, law that actually engages our loyalty, is law that comes from the command of a sovereign. Obviously, sociologically, positivism might well be right. That is, states create things that they call laws and they enforce them at gunpoint. But if we're going to talk about what's actually a reasonable source of maintaining order, there's no reason to think that law has to come from the command of an arbitrary authority from Hobbes's Leviathan. The model that I'm working with is a kind of two-stage model. So first of all, there is natural law. That is, there are underlying normative principles that apply across a range of situations that are rooted in the way human beings are put together, that are rooted in kind of what is needed for humans to flourish, for human lives to go well. And so these natural law principles provide a kind of bedrock moral grounding for just law. We recognize that that foundation isn't going to be acknowledged by everyone, but that at any rate is a key source of law for people to recognize it. Then on top of that, we have reason, I think, in terms of the natural law principles I elaborate, to favor the imposition of authority in virtue of consent. And so when people can consent to associate in particular ways, they can also consent to various kinds of rules as operative within the particular association they form. So we can imagine then both kind of general principles, which are the sorts of things on which I hope these different associations might converge, which would turn out to be, I think, the basic principles of the natural law, and then various consensual principles, part of the more particular legal regimes that would govern interactions in particular contexts and would be consent-based. So I don't need to consent to a rule that I not murder or torture you, but I might well need to consent to some rule, let us say, for instance, about abandonment of a piece of property or the formalization of a contract. And different legal regimes would, it seems to me, formulate and implement those kinds of rules. So I think law would come both from the natural law and from the consent of individual participants in varying systems.
I'm very interested, of course, in the enforcement of law. This is also tricky for people to see. You have a section, a regime could forcibly resolve conflicts without laws, without becoming morally indistinguishable from a state. Now, Bob Murphy, who, as you know, has written about these topics,
yes,
has suggested that, or has posited a theory in which there would not necessarily need to be violence exerted against an outlaw, because what would happen is that nobody would be willing to do business with this person. And there might be isolated pockets where people will say, you can come onto our property and get your life together and maybe do some remunerative work because no one else will take you. And so they'll voluntarily segregate themselves from the rest of society until such time as society is ready to take them back. I'm not sure I'm completely convinced of that. What is your mechanism? And I know Bob listens every day, so I don't know what's going to happen now. But what's your approach to this question?
So I'm very fond of Bob's work in chaos theory, and I believe I cite it a couple of points in the book. I think Bob does some great stuff there. But the model you've just described, which involves, for instance, exclusion, is still one that's necessarily, at least in principle, going to be backed up by force, right? I mean, if the outlaws you were just talking about do want to enter people's property, and those people regard them as not safe, I mean, Bob, as I recall, talks about the importance of people being bonded or having you know, basically insurance backup, not having that when there are people who have histories of violence and rapacity. And so because they lack that surety, they're not able per the property owner's wishes to enter the property. Obviously, that's not self-enforcing, and it's not enforcing. It's enforceable just in virtue of the goodwill of the outlaw. If the outlaw had the goodwill to avoid entering the people's property without their consent, probably that person wouldn't be an outlaw in the first place. So I think that we are still talking about a model, even as Bob has laid it out, in which there is the potential threat of force to restrain or exclude people, right? I don't think that consideration goes away. What I think Bob has really offered is a model in particular that might help us see alternatives to imprisonment. And I think that's marvelous.
That's a better description of it. That's right.
Yeah, it's not an alternative to enforcement. It's not, the force is still there, but it may be that voluntary segregation can happen without imprisonment. My view is that somebody who is reasonably judged to be engaged in an ongoing kind of program or campaign of violence, it can be, if necessary, forcibly restrained in the same way that one might imagine a combatant who hasn't laid down his or her arms being restrained in wartime. And so I think that in such cases, and I don't try to spell out just when that would be, it's not unreasonable to think that in a very free society, we still could, if necessary, employ something that might seem closer to conventional imprisonment for some people, but I'd much prefer Bob's model, right? I think prison's bad news for everybody. It creates bad incentives. It creates bad character traits. And the kind of voluntary self-segregation created by the existence of a network of property rights that allow the exclusion of the potentially violent that Bob talks about, I think is great. And I'd certainly prefer that all around. Not sure if I've gotten at everything you were asking.
No, that's good. Now, I'm also curious about, again, it really comes down to your views of property, because I could see somebody who is opposed to property rights to one degree or another, thinking that the regime you're describing is not in its fundamentals different from a state, because they think of the state as being an enforcement mechanism for private property. Well, now you are just taking that and putting a little exponent next to it. They would view it, I think, as somewhat indistinguishable. But you're saying here that there are key aspects in which the two are morally distinguishable.
Right. So, unavoidably, we have to do some moral spade work here, right? I begin with the view, and I don't just posit it, I devote the better part of 100 pages to arguing for it. In chapter 2, I begin with the view that natural law theory grounds robust property rights, which are separate from, distinguishable from, independent of state action. Okay? So if I'm right about that, then property rights can be understood to be independent of the state, and an entity which defends those property rights is defending natural rights in much the same way that it would be if it were defending people against bodily assault. It's worth noting, by the way, here, when my book, The Conscience of an Anarchist, came out, I did an interview several years ago with an anarcho-communist group that had found the book interesting and wanted to talk about it. And one thing I found intriguing about that, because it's anarcho-communist literature, unfortunately, is not a literature I know as well as I might like to. And so I was interested that these guys were very quick to say, look, we've got problems with property, but those problems with property are not problems with the this is my language, not theirs, but with the possession of those resources that people need for the ongoing operation of their lives. So their account of possessory claims definitely didn't involve people being excluded from their own homes and not having the tools they needed to work and so forth. So I'm not sure, just because of the sheer essential practicality of giving people responsibility for particular things, that the gap between narco-communists and other kinds of market anarchists would necessarily be as great as we're sometimes perhaps concerned that it might be. But in any event, I'm making a normative argument of the book that there are basic natural rights claims to the property, and that an entity which defends those, therefore, is morally reasonable and isn't state-like, just like an entity that defends people's bodies against violence is morally reasonable and isn't state-like. The state acts contrary to people's consent, controlling their bodies and their labor and their property without that consent. And what I try to show is that basic legal rules and legal regimes in a free society could operate with consent. The one qualifier being you don't need consent to enforce basic moral rules. So that's the way I would make the distinction.
Well, sometime in the future, I want to have you come on and talk about your exposition of natural law theory and what it has to say to us about property. That would make a interesting conversation in and of itself. I do want to do that, and I do want to hit on a few other topics in this book at some point in the future. But before I let you go today, the question that would still be in people's minds, and of course I urge people, just read the book, of course. It's a detailed argument. It's systematic. It's provocative. You're not going to be bored reading it, that's for sure. The book is Anarchy and Legal Order. How, in a given case, would a stateless approach to dispute resolution handle just a simple case of theft or anything else where it seems that we would have to force the parties into the courtroom and we would have to have some political appointee decide who's in the right and who's in the wrong, and we've got to, and then we have to force people to come and sit and hear the case for $40 a day or whatever the going rate is. What's different in the regime you're envisioning?
Well, so fundamentally, a consent-based regime is going, I trust, to build in incentives for cooperation, right? So all of us need help resolving disputes. We all either intentionally or inadvertently bump up against the boundaries of other people's claims, however those claims are defined, whatever they are. And so each of us has an incentive to find ways of resolving disputes peacefully and efficiently. I suggest that a fairly straightforward way of thinking about this, one that's been worked out by economists and political theorists for some time, involves people affiliating with each other in one way or another. I talk in general terms about legal regimes because what I envision would be a whole set of different sorts of associations people might have. Some of them might be purely bottom-up, voluntary clubs, in effect, in which people would get together to cooperate with each other in funding and sustaining dispute resolution institutions. Some might instead build on existing legal codes. Think about rabbinical law or canon law in the Catholic Church. One can imagine those being extended in various ways and people affiliating with entities that lay those out and making those their primary homes in terms of the law. But in any event, people are going to want to cooperate and affiliate with each other to resolve disputes about fundamental matters that might otherwise prompt forcible conflict. So, suppose, for instance, you talk about a case of theft. I walk off with your wallet. So, at that point, presuming, and this is an issue obviously that raises other complications, but presuming you are able to identify me as the thief, and you want to both get the wallet back and then also, of course, be compensated for your time and trouble in doing that. You're not made whole if you just get the wallet back. You certainly also need compensation for the incidental. You now want to initiate a legal case against me. Well, the simplest option to consider is one in which you and I are participants in the same legal regime. So I've already consented to the jurisdiction of that regime by being a member, and not only have I consented so that there's some kind of moral obligation on me to cooperate, but also I want the defense of that regime. I want it to support me. And if I decline to cooperate with it, it may well be that I'll forfeit its protection. Certainly, I'll also forfeit any credibility I might have in dealing with anyone else where the issue of my having the support of any regime is an issue. So I've certainly got some incentive to participate. If I don't participate, of course, in this legal case against me, I might simply be the victim of default judgment. I probably don't want that either. Because if I am the victim of default judgment, then, of course, the regime's going to be entitled to claim resources from me as needed to satisfy that judgment. Well, suppose then, by contrast, I'm a member of another legal regime, participant in some other legal regime rather than in yours. Well, at that point, again, you're going to want to mount a case against me for the same kind of compensation. But at that point, an agreement probably between my legal regime and your legal regime would kick in, one that would govern cross-regime disputes. And again, regimes would have reason to want to make resolution of those disputes as simple as possible. But they're going to want to avoid violence and enhance their own credibility. Some critics of this sort of approach, famously Ayn Rand, seem to think that the regimes are going to want to shoot it out. But it seems fairly clear that regimes are long-term players. They're not going to want to engage in violence, both because of the reputational problems involved and because of the cost involved, even if they're utterly amoral. And obviously, if they have moral constraints, all the more reason why that wouldn't be the case. So the regimes will want to facilitate conflict resolution. Again, will want to assert jurisdiction over the respective members and bring them into a situation in which the conflict can be resolved. And if I get judgment against you, you get a judgment against me, rather, my regime is going to have good reason to want to assist your regime in enforcing that judgment. So it gets complicated, and we can talk about all the various features of the system, but the bottom line, I think, is that both normative constraints and a variety of efficiency and related constraints are going to dispose people to cooperate with each other within legal reason.
Well, Gary, there's so many other topics we can hit on, and I'd like to do that with you at some point in the future. But for now, I want to urge people that if this topic is one that holds some interest for you, and I know for a lot of you it does, a lot of us think about stuff like this all the time, actually, then the book to read is Anarchy and Legal Order, and the subtitle is Law and Politics for a Stateless Society, by our guest today, Gary Chartier. Gary, as always, we enjoy talking to you and learning from you, and we'll have to do it again soon.
Look forward to it, Tom.
All right, everybody, a couple quick things before I let you run. I've got a few dates to run by you. I'm going to be in Houston January 24th. Remember, it's the Mises Circle in Houston. Lou Rockwell, Ron Paul, Jeff Dice, and I will be speaking there. It's always a great time. Then in February, it looks like we are nailing down an event at Florida Atlantic University. I'll be able to give you more details on that soon. Then April, I realize this is far in the future, but it's one of these save the date things. April 9th, I'll be at American University in, I think that's in Washington, D.C. proper. I don't know for sure. I've never been there. But it's certainly in the D.C. area anyway. Then April, the weekend of the 24th, 25th, I'll be in Montreal for personal reasons, but I believe Mises Canada is going to help me put on at least a little event, maybe a lunchtime event on that Saturday. Then in May 22nd, I'm having an event in Dublin, Ireland, and if you are in Ireland, please drop me a note via the contact page at tomwoods.com so I can put you on my little list to update you on the details of that event. It won't be a list that I'll use for any other purpose, just if you happen to live there, I will send you a note to let you know what's going on with that. Remember, too, that my new book is available. It's called Real Dissent, of course. A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. Check it out at realdissent.com. If you're listening to and enjoying this program, this book is for you. And, of course, you can get a free audiobook version of the book with me reading it at tomwoodsaudio.com. We won't be having a program on Thanksgiving Day, but we'll have a program every weekday this week, except Thursday. So I hope you'll keep on tuning in and subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher to The Tom Woods Show. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.